Tomboy X, the queer-founded clothing line that's inclusive and sustainable. Underwear, swimwear, and more for all bodies. So you can feel good about protecting the goods. It's our anniversary, so from April 10th to 14th, get 25% off your order at tomboyx.com.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of November 28th, 2016. On this week's show, we're going to talk about Ohio State's overtime win over Michigan, the drama therein, and the joy and sadness of college football rivalries. We'll also talk about U.S. soccer's decision to dump Jurgen Klinsmann and to replace him with Bruce Arena, the coach who led the U.S. team at the 2002 and 2006 World Cups. And Oliver Rader of 538 will join us to discuss the World Chess Championship match between Norway's Magnus Carlsen and Russia's Sergei Karjakin. Joining me is Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Hello, Stefan.
Joining you in Washington.
All right.
Are we hiding our location? We're in a secret location, the Slate bunker.
I kind of tweak these every week, and sometimes I forget to add back in the standard. I had written congratulations on not missing an extra point on Sunday, Stefan.
Thank you.
Should I just say that every week?
Yeah.
Still didn't miss an extra point. Still perfect. Joining us as always from New York is Mike Pesca, the host of Slate's daily podcast, The Gist. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Congratulate me on holding everyone on the offensive line to get a safety to run out the clock.
So I don't know if that's whimsy. You guys were tossing around some – I feel like the definition of whimsy is always – loose and flexible in a fun and happy way, but
yeah, it's a whimsical definition. It would be weird to have a staunch whimsy definition. Yeah.
But it can get stretched to just mean things that happened that I enjoy,
which is okay. You have a problem with that?
I do.
That looked like something out of the Marx Brothers football movie. That was awesome. That was whimsical.
It depends on the scoring. If you use Enter
correct,
the Gladiators.
I was just going to say. Yeah.
Yeah, if you use Spike Jones. Yeah, but bum, bada, bum, bum, bum. Then it's sad.
So whimsy was the Bears wide receiver dropping the ball and then kicking it and then having the kicked ball go directly into a security guard's butt. Mm-hmm. That's whimsy. There's no debating it. That's a pure 10.0. The East Germans think that's whimsy. This other stuff, it's up to your individual perception. The thing that I thought was funny about that Ravens holding play is that according to the rules, there's nothing the refs can do about it. You've just got to allow them to do it, except if the refs decided it was a palpably unfair act.
Yeah.
At which point all bets are off. You can just, you know, do whatever you want as a referee. But I love the use of the modifier palpably.
Mm-hmm. See, to me, the palpably
unfair act, that's a whimsical modifier.
It's a whim. Many adverbs are. To me, the palpably unfair act has got to be the needle that every referee drives the camel through. Wait, huh? What I'm saying is the equivalent of best interests of the game. That's what palpably unfair act is. And that's the only way to redress all these crazy penalties. And if someone hadn't seen the game, the Ravens were up by a touchdown. It was one play left in the game. They were to punt to the Bengals, not wanting to do that. Their offensive line in a punt formation held everyone, and the Ravens took a safety. And the reason why they held was so that, you know, nothing bad would happen, I guess, while the 15 seconds got expended by the taking of the safety. But the rules do not allow for an extra play after that penalty is called. So they knew that they could get away scot-free.
So this is a good transition in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members today. We're going to talk about a high school football game in Illinois where the refs made a mistake. And the mistake was basically misapplying the rule that Mike just described, that they gave an extra down at the end of a game when they shouldn't have given it. And the losing team took that ruling to court. We will discuss this in our bonus segment. There's never been a better time to sign up for Slate Plus. For Slate's 20th anniversary, for a limited time, we're offering 30% off an annual membership. That's just $35 for a year of Slate Plus with bonus segments on this and other Slate podcasts every week and a lot more. So if you haven't joined Plus yet, sign up before the offer goes away at slate.com/hangupplus.
I would be remiss if I didn't note that there was a 14-5 game on Sunday. 14-5 is only the second in NFL history.
It's the five.
When that five popped up on the board, I got very, very excited, Mike. I went right to Pro Football Reference.
Yeah. This is also the season where scores come up and you're like, oh my God, Duke has 68. And then you realize it's a basketball game, except I was watching that classic Big East basketball game from 1987 where Pitt beat Syracuse 76-61. And then I thought to myself, my God, how did they hold Billy Owens to the few points, the Pitt Panthers? And it wasn't a basketball game. It was a football game.
On Saturday in Columbus, Ohio, number 2 Ohio State beat its rival, number 3 Michigan, 30-27 in double overtime. The win basically locks up a spot in college football's 4-team playoff for Ohio State, which is now 11-1. And it probably means the 10-2 Michigan will get left out. In the second overtime, Ohio State quarterback JT Barrett barely got a first down when he ran the ball into the line on 4th-and-1. And if you're a Michigan fan, you probably think he didn't get it and your team got screwed. And if you're Michigan coach Jim Harbaugh, then you definitely think he didn't get it and you definitely think your team got screwed. Here is Harbaugh ranting about the refs after the game.
I'm bitterly disappointed with the officiating today. That spot, the graphic display is the interference penalties. The one not called on us, on Grant Perry, clearly was being hooked before the ball got there. And the previous penalty they called on Delano Hill, the ball is uncatchable and by the receiver. See, I'm bitterly disappointed in the officiating. Can't make that any more clear.
Joining us now is our colleague and resident Michigan fan, Ben Mathis-Lilly, who is also bitterly disappointed about this game. Hello, Ben.
Hi, guys.
And we should bracket all this. So we're recording this on Monday morning, and there's an active shooter on the Ohio State campus. We don't really know the story is developing, but we can stipulate at the top of the segment that we know how unimportant all of this is, and yet we can we'll still engage in the conversation because there's a lot of passion going on here, especially on the Michigan message boards. Ben, tell us what the experience has been like, what it was like during the game, and then what kind of rabbit holes have been have been gone down in the days since.
So, you know, I've come to dread this game. So I think before the game, I was frightened. During the game, I was anxious. And after the game, I was obviously, you know, in the sports fan sense, devastated by the outcome, but not entirely surprised. I don't think there was at any actual point during the game in which I really expected to win. And so when the end happened, I have about 15 years of dealing with this kind of experience with the Ohio State game. That said, yes, I'm completely on the bandwagon of people who think JT Barrett did not make the first down. I have looked at a lot of the screenshots. And in fact, read up on the links that are being sent around about the head referee in the Michigan Ohio State game actually having been dismissed in 2002 by the Big Ten for what was apparently a very very poor performance in a Purdue Wake Forest game. So I'm about halfway down the rabbit hole, I would say.
Is your all caps lock key fixed though?
I've gotten, you know, for the hour after the game, I received and sent a lot of profanity-filled text messages using words such as disillusioned, despondent, and devastated.
You also tweeted people being all lol at the people who are mad about the 4th-and-1 because it wasn't their team can eat a shit sandwich in hell. I thought that was pretty good.
I did. And that was there's a particular kind of reaction, and I'm sure I've taken part in it when I was not one of the interested parties before. When there's one of these kind of calls and you just and the reaction of some people is just to kind of laugh and shrug your shoulders and say, well, you know, who knows what actually happened, and isn't it silly that people are taking it so seriously? And my response to that is like, well, this is the biggest game. I mean, if you're a fan of these teams, like, you know, you take it seriously. It's sports. We all recognize that. But, you know, why not? I mean, why not look at screenshots to try to figure out if he made the first down or not? You know, like, just, you know, give us this time. Give us this time to get through the process, I guess.
So what did you two guys think about the first down? Let's go with that one. That's video forensics that anyone could have an opinion on.
I thought in real time. It looked like he probably made it. And I thought, having watched many of these football games and listened to all of the analysts tell us over and over again that there has to be clear evidence to overturn a call, that there is
clear and compelling.
There is there was absolutely no way that the call was going to get overturned if it wasn't called, you know, short of the first down originally. So it didn't even strike me that anything like super controversial happened. Obviously, it was an extremely close play, and obviously, there's no way that they're going to precisely get the spot right. Like, that's one of the great hilarious fictions of football, is that you have the guy like run in and just place the ball down at random. But it seemed like they could have called it either way, and it didn't strike me as any sort of conspiracy either way.
Yeah, and there was also no good camera angle to determine whether he crossed. It was right at the 15-yard line, so it was something where you could actually look at if you had a straight-on angle, but there was no straight-on.
It did make me think, though, that the next kind of innovation in college football after the first down line is
chip.
Why couldn't you have a camera down the line? Mm-hmm. Because you know where the first down marker is every time, so why couldn't
like you
just
do at the end zone.
Have like a...
Why couldn't like you have a camera in the first down marker? Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Well, the chains like might get tangled.
Yeah, and the little orange dot on the top of the first down marker.
So I looked at that and I thought that I agree with Josh. It seemed, of course, extremely close. I think perhaps tricking our minds is that he didn't end up with the first down. But let's remember that as for all the flaws of technology that we talked about, there is one guy with the perfect angle and he is standing right on the line and he is looking to see if at any point that ball in any way crosses the imaginary first down marker. And that was the referee. Now, Ben, you could talk about how this guy 14 years ago was dismissed. So anyway, I thought it was an extremely close call. And of course, partisans of one side via a lot of psychological phenomena that has been routinely studied. You know, this is actually a studied phenomenon that fans literally see things different ways. But I thought that was an extremely close call that went against Michigan. I thought the pass interference call where it was high and the Kirk Herbstreit said the Michigan player didn't even need to commit the interference because that ball seemed to be by him. But still, again, a close call that I can understand why a Michigan fan is upset with. Yet, he did collide with a receiver who plausibly maybe could have made a play on the ball. You can't say it was totally uncatchable. And then the third, Grant Perry interference, is a call that Michigan didn't get that teams sometimes don't get. And it reminded me of that Super Bowl with Seattle against Pittsburgh, where there were a bunch of calls really close and they all did go against Seattle. Yet I couldn't point to one or two that was like, that was egregious. So that's what I think was going on. They didn't get any close calls. I don't know if they should have, but if all these calls were like 55-45, the law of averages says, you know, give them one.
Well, I think that the egregious part of the interference call was that it was the exact same action by the defender grabbing the right shoulder pad of the receiver and preventing his right arm from extending to try to get to the ball. And, you know, Harbaugh has a case. I think Michigan got jobbed. And I say that as a minor Michigan fan. Relatives in Michigan went to a bunch of games in the Big House when I was a kid. But still, it did seem patently. He had a case to be pissed off.
Yeah, if that gets called a penalty, the announcers don't say that's not a penalty. Yeah, I think that was probably a penalty. But it's also the sort of very close play that often doesn't get called as a penalty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you brought up the psychological, I mean, the psychological element to it. I mean, you've all probably also seen the study that said that if there is such a thing as home field advantage happening for any specific reason, it's that the biggest contributor to it is that you just get more calls at home. And just to be clear, I don't believe any of these theories, the more extreme version of the theory that the refs wanted Ohio State to win. I think that's ridiculous. I don't think they cared. But you're in a stadium with 110,000 people going nuts. I think it's completely natural that you're going to maybe favor that team a little bit. And Michigan would have got the same advantage if they had been at home. But that's, you know, you're right. It's just a bunch of 50-50 calls and they all went one way. But there was also the unsportsmanlike conduct penalty for throwing his pen or throwing a play sheet or whatever it was, which was kind of a unusual call to penalize a coach for tossing something in the air.
I think they said it landed on the 50-yard line. I mean, that was one where it's like Harbaugh hurt his team and was, I like Harbaugh, I understand the intensity, but he is a huge crybaby, and he did do something wrong. And, you know, when you throw a sheet onto the 50-yard line, and then to listen to his explanation for it was, that's a technical in basketball. Well, this is, so anyway, he asked the ref, why'd you call that? They said, well, in basketball, that's a technical if you believe Harbaugh. And Harbaugh says, this isn't basketball. Well, it is all, you are a professional not trying to hurt your team. And I know you're emotional, but he's always doing crap like that with pens and papers and all sorts of accoutrements. Keep it to yourself, Harbaugh.
Pens and papers.
Yeah, remember mm-hmm. he's got all sorts of props.
Well, it's never been a penalty before. So it's either a penalty or it's not. You know, I mean, I agree. You know, if you're going to penalize that, then it's ridiculous that he's doing it and he should stop doing it. But, you know, I didn't go back and review the tape on this, but I saw, you know, Urban Meyer broke his headset during a national championship game 2 years ago.
But that didn't leave the sideline. Like the announcers, I didn't see any tape. The announcer says it landed on the 50-yard line. Now, I assume that didn't mean the 50-yard line on the sidelines. I assume that meant whatever, because it was windy. It blew out onto the field. And that's where it's like, it's not, look, you can do whatever you want on your own sideline. As soon as it's on my field, you're getting a penalty. I think that's perfectly reasonable.
But okay, so Ben, my question is about the clip that we heard from Harbaugh.
Yeah.
After the game, and sort of what is his responsibility or what should it be? I mean, he is performing some fan service there, right? Like he's right. voicing what the fans are feeling, but should he be like more magnanimous? Should he,
sure.
you know, quote unquote, accept the outcome of the election?
Well, one thing I wanted to point out is that in knowing Harbaugh, this was almost certainly intentional. When Michigan and Ohio State were both up for the Rose Bowl in 1973, and it actually had to be decided via a vote of Big Ten athletic directors who got to go, the vote went in Ohio State's favor, and Ohio State won the Rose Bowl. And Bo Schembechler, after that, said, and you can see the clips of him saying this, I'm very bitter about the result of the vote. So Harbaugh was if we bring up the idea of fan service, Harbaugh was making kind of a deep cut reference probably to a similar incident in 1973.
That's good shit. Yeah. I like that.
Which is kind of like one of the, yeah, it's like that's why people like college football right there. You know, that's the attachment is that kind of continuity. But, you know, I didn't think he went too far with the comments. You know, he was disappointed. He didn't say we lost the game because of the refs. I mean, anyone who watched the game knew that Michigan still could have won the game about 15 times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, despite all these calls.
Yeah, they fumbled the ball at the 1 yard line.
Yeah, I mean, and they let the guy score on the next play after 4th and 1, you know, I mean, there were millions of things. And if he had said something like there was a conspiracy against us and the refs took it away from us, I think that'd be ridiculous. But yeah, to just express what the people at home are thinking and to show that his kind of, passion for the game is similar to theirs. I think there's nothing wrong with that. And I don't think he said anything, you know, to kind of disparage the Ohio State players' effort or their performance or anything like that. So I don't know. I thought that was within reason.
I also think it's good tactics in light of the fact that this is a subjective decision about who gets in, and there's still a chance for Michigan to get in. And if you give rise to the theory, hey, they were kind of screwed, one or two voters can be swayed by that.
Right. If they're going to, you know, if things go haywire and they're not sure who to put in the fourth spot, in the playoff, that kind of lobbying could certainly help their cause.
Do they even need lobbying, Ben? I mean, this was a 10-2 team that
Don't
lost
ask Ben
two
that
games.
Question.
Well, I'm gonna throw the softball for him. That lost two games by a total of 4 points, both on the last play of the game. They clearly outplayed Ohio State over the course of the game. I thought so, except for the end where they had chances to win and they kind of blew it.
Except when their quarterback kept throwing interceptions and the other team running.
Ohio State had like 50 yards passing going into the fourth quarter. I mean, it wasn't as if Ohio State dominated this game. They certainly didn't. Can you say that Ohio State is a better football team overall than Michigan?
Michigan had 2 million more votes than Ohio State.
So I think there is a plausible case to be made. If the charge of the playoff committee, the 12 people that will sit in a hotel room and decide who gets to play for the College Football National Championship, is to pick the four best teams, I don't know that Ohio State's any better than Michigan.
I completely agree. And I mean, if you look at the other contenders to get into the weeds on it, Michigan has actually beaten three of them, Colorado, Penn State, and Wisconsin. So, yeah, I mean, I certainly think that if you were going to pick the four best teams, that Michigan would have a very good case to be the fourth team. I also think that everyone is going to get demolished by, 53-0 by Alabama. So it's kind of just a completely moot argument.
Yes, I did look at these two teams and I said strengths minuses. I don't see two really flawed teams. And it's hard to tell just by teams matching up who's if maybe it's the other teams causing the flaws. But it does seem that Ohio State and Michigan are flawed teams. I mean, just compare this Ohio State team to last year's team. Possibly unfair, sure. But it seems like last year's team is so much better. Then again, I don't understand how last year's team didn't win the national championship. But that's that.
Yeah, and especially if we're looking at this as who could best challenge Alabama, the Michigan quarterbacking situation seems not ideal.
Nope.
In that
they
regard.
Don't have a quarterback. And also, they do have a quarterbacking situation. That is true.
Also, I just feel like this is a case where anti-West Coast bias is playing a role because mm-hmm. Washington has been a bit off the radar for the last few years. Everybody knows that Chris Peterson is a great coach. People, kind of know that Jake Browning is a good quarterback. But that is a really good team. And if you look at just the consensus of all the computer rankings, if you just average them all, then Michigan is just ahead of Washington. And then if Washington wins the Pac-12 championship by beating a Colorado team that, yes, Michigan has already beaten. But if they beat Colorado, I think it would be hard to argue. It's impossible to argue that Michigan is clearly better than Washington. I think it would be hard to argue to leave Washington out of the playoff at the expense of Michigan.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, one loss Washington definitely deserves to get it. I'm actually the playoff thing, it doesn't, as a fan, I think we lost our chance, I mean, I think that obviously it was a tight game and I think we should have won, but this counts as a playoff game. I mean, we don't need to see Ohio State and Michigan play again. Ohio State won the game. So, put Washington in there, put someone else in there. I don't like the idea of pulling for a rematch in the playoff, unless, like I said, everything goes haywire and every other team has two losses. But yeah, like this was their shot and they missed it. And that's what part of what made it so frustrating. Mm-hmm.
Ben Mathis-Lilley, you've been a great ambassador for your state and the university. Thank you very much for joining us.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Last Monday, very rudely, just after we'd recorded that week's podcast, U.S. Soccer announced it was dumping Jurgen Klinsmann after 5 years as coach and technical director of the national team. That national team had just started the final round of qualifying for the 2018 World Cup with losses to Mexico at home, 2-1, and to Costa Rica on the road, 4-0. In a statement, Sunil Gulati, the president of U.S. Soccer, said, "While we remain confident that we have quality players to help us advance to Russia 2018, the form and growth of the team up to this point left us convinced that we need to go in a different direction. The different direction the team is going in is not really a different direction. The new coach is an old coach, Bruce Arena, who led the team to the 2002 and 2006 World Cups before being replaced by Bob Bradley, who was in turn replaced by Klinsmann. Stefan, Arena's 65 years old. He's clearly a stopgap for U.S. soccer. He's an American. He's familiar with the player pool from his long tenure in MLS and with the national team. And he presumably can get the team to perform well enough to at least get into the top three of qualifying in CONCACAF and make it to the World Cup in 2018. Is that the right move, the right thought process for the U.S. program right now?
I don't have a problem with it. He knows how to manage qualifying. He knows CONCACAF teams. He knows how difficult it is to play on the road in this region. Like you said, he's familiar with the core players. He knows what MLS players might be worth bringing in for auditions or spots on the team. Tactically, it's not going to be a gigantic change. I think the idea here is to get the United States to the World Cup finals in Russia in 2018. And then after that, I think Galati, who I don't think will be displaced as the head of U.S. soccer anytime soon, after that, I think they go for some big name South American or European coach that has a better tactical and management track record than Jurgen Klinsmann does.
Well, before we get to Mike, why do you think that Galati won't get replaced?
Because I think he has amassed an enormous amount of power inside U.S. soccer, and he has elevated U.S. soccer's reputation and influence within world soccer inside FIFA. He's on the executive committee. He's taken U.S. soccer to places where it's never been inside the organization of the sport internationally. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, given FIFA's, right. FIFA's decades of corruption, I mean, it is a fact that Sunil Galati is actually listened to by people inside FIFA.
Presumably having an old hand in place would help with getting the 2026 World Cup.
Yes, it's all politics.
I'll give you another reason why he will be retained, because he is the president of the federation with the best soccer team in the world, with the soccer team that mm-hmm. has redefined the sport, the team that won the last World Cup and was a finalist in the World Cup beforehand and is a huge Olympic champion. I'm, of course, talking about the U.S. women's team, and the fact that we say, well, why would he be retained and is he doing a bad job? Of course, only looks at it through the prism of the men's team. And then when we look at the women's team, you could make an argument, but does he really deserve so much credit with the women's team? The women are claiming that, you know, they're being treated as second class citizens. But he has overseen their success as the best in the world. So it's either they are second class citizens or they aren't. If we don't treat him as second class citizens, he was the guy at the helm when they achieved their greatness.
So back to Klinsmann. You can really slice and dice his record in a bunch of different ways. There were some really good moments for the team, you know, winning the group at the 2014 World Cup. And when that draw came out, everyone said that they weren't going to make it through. There was a huge amount of doubt there. You could argue that they didn't perform particularly well on the field or didn't look good at the 2014 World Cup. And you could make the same argument at the Copa America when they made the semifinals and didn't look particularly awesome doing it. You know, they beat Germany and the Netherlands in friendlies. They lost to Guatemala. When you add it all up, I think you can create a narrative that can cut either way. And it seems like a lot of this was personal and that people didn't like him, both within U.S. soccer and in the fan community, that he never would take personal blame for anything that the team did. He would always, you know, blame the players by name or the kind of unknowing and unthinking, you know, stupid soccer fans who just didn't understand the game at the level that he did. And so I think when you have a record that can cut both ways, you need to be a good politician. And he really was not.
No, he wasn't. And look, the cutting the bad way is more. I mean, there was a Gold Cup semifinal loss to Jamaica. The youth program overall development that Klinsmann was put in charge of overhauling. U23 team didn't make the Olympics twice under his watch. Didn't make it to the Confederations Cup, the pre-World Cup tournament the year before. Blown out by Colombia in that Copa America as well.
And Argentina.
That was Maya as well. Tactically, and he also overpromised. I mean, Klinsmann came in saying we're going to create an American style. It'll be attacking. And occasionally against weaker opponents in friendlies, it showed up. But overall, there wasn't a whole lot of progress. I think you can argue that teams under Bob Bradley or under Bruce Arena 14 years ago were better than the teams that Jurgen Klinsmann assembled. And it was clear because of the inconsistency that he delivered in putting lineups together, playing players out of position, throwing in weird formations from time to time, his loyalty to certain older players or German-American players that weren't performing that well in a lot of these games, that he lost the players. And I'll go back to my pet peeve of not putting Landon Donovan on the World Cup team. I think that alienated players too. Brian Strauss had written a piece in 2013 for the Sporting News that quoted, you know, two dozen people, mostly off the record, talking about Klinsmann's flaws. And a lot of those, I think, proved to be true.
You know, if Grady Little gets fired for leaving in Pedro, why doesn't Klinsmann get fired for that one thing of leaving Donovan off the team, which a stupid soccer fan like me says, that doesn't seem to make sense. And then they go through the tournament. It's like, you know what they need? A Landon Donovan type player. And then it comes out after the tournament. Not having Landon Donovan on the team hurt the cohesion of the team. And I understand why he promised, oh, we're going to have an attacking style, because that was the thing that the team lacked. So, you know, if you come in as a basketball coach and the team's bad at defense, you're going to say, we're going to preach defense. But if you come in as a coach and the team is a good defense and you can't score, you're going to say, we're going to open up the offense. So that's what you promise, because that's what we want. And for a second or two, it seemed that maybe Clint Dempsey could put the ball in the back of the net, but we just never have the attackers with flair who could finish the job. But to me, Klinsmann also seems, and Stefan, you would know more than me, but it seems like he was the kind of guy who wanted to win because he's a professional and he has an ego, but he wanted to win his way, and he kind of wanted to prove a point by winning his way. You know, some people would say this about Don Coryell, that, you know, he'd like to win, but he really wants to impress you with how, you know, crazy his offense is and all these schemes that he could make. And it seems to me that Klinsmann wanted people to say, wow, the United States won the Klinsmann way. And the United States isn't good enough that you could even sacrifice any parts of the whatever natural advantages you have by saying, you know, we're going to subjugate some natural advantages so Klinsmann can put his stamp on things.
Well, I don't even think that was evident. I mean, it's very hard in international soccer to create style and change something, even in a short period of time, like 5 years. I mean, these players play for their club teams predominantly. They get together for camps that are a week or 2 weeks at the most. So it's hard to develop a kind of cohesive style. And I think it does take a force of personality and someone that these players who are flying in from all around the world really buy into trying to create something that they take direction from on a high, and they believe that something different is being passed on to them. And I don't think Klinsmann offered that. I think Klinsmann was kind of a blowhard. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of it was about fitness and nutrition and teamwork and caring and finding your comfort zone. And this was sort of ethereal bullshit in a lot of ways. But ultimately, I don't think that's what ended up costing him his job. I think U.S. soccer, Galati and others, probably just got sick of his excuses. There was a telling paragraph in a piece by Doug McIntyre on ESPN over the weekend in which he says that in private, Klinsmann's excuses were even more bold. He told Galati he was convinced that the Gold Cup was fixed so Mexico would win, setting up the big money playoff match against the U.S. to go to the Confederations Cup. I mean, that's just insane if true.
Mm-hmm. I think that the U.S. was in the, you know, if you look at where they were in the last World Cup, in the round of 16. And I think the U.S. has a conception that they're not one of the 10 best teams in the world, but they should be in the next 10. And their rankings before Klinsmann and during Klinsmann are now in the 30s. And if you add that up and you combine 4-0 against Costa Rica, most coaches with that track record are going to get fired in a federation that sees itself as underperforming by 10, 12 spots in the world rankings where they should.
Well, I think most coaches would have been fired before he was, but I don't think that's necessarily – like, it's always struck me as kind of bizarre how trigger-happy both club and national team, you know, soccer is. Like, hockey is another example where they just seem to fire coaches, like, every week for no particular reason, just because that's the culture of the sport. So I don't think saying that, like, oh, Klinsmann would have been fired earlier – if he was in another country necessarily means that other country would have been more rational. Like, I think I tend to think more than you guys do that this was a good bet, one that didn't work out. And I think people have just gone a little overboard and saying the program's in like way worse shape than it was than when he got there. He expanded the player pool. I think there are a lot of guys playing for the U.S. now that wouldn't have come there, and not necessarily just German ones, maybe like Aaron Johansson, mm-hmm. who's from Iceland, or, you know, who you can name a bunch of other ones who wouldn't be playing for the
and
U.S.
He persuaded them to play, to cap them. He got them to join the team. And I think that he deserves a lot of credit for that.
And Christian Pulisic and Bobby Wood are both
really good.
And a
cap is to lock them up. Yeah, we'll have them forever now. We've ruined them for other countries. Way to go, Jürgen. He was the best pimp. Bad coach. Great pimp.
These are really good young players. And I think to argue that this team is in the dumpster now because of Klinsmann is, I think, counterfactual.
Absolutely.
There were a bunch of bad results, especially in the region, but it's really easy. It's like too easy. Like they fucked up. It's too easy to get to the World Cup out of this region. And I think because of that, it buys U.S. soccer and Galati and whoever else the opportunity to experiment. And if your goal is really to win the World Cup, everything that, you know, I think you were saying this, Mike, basically like you're not good enough to do X or Y as the U.S. Well, that's definitely true. But I think you are – the region is weak enough that you can take the risk of like taking a temporary hit on your team, like making your team worse as being the like downside with the potential upside of like making it awesome.
You can do a rebuild if it is a rebuild.
Right.
If it's just a tear down without the rebuild, that's not good.
Well, what Klinsmann definitely pointed out flaws in the U.S. system, the structure from youth to national team. What's not clear if he made any significant steps toward fixing that.
Okay,
and that was supposed to be his strength. And that's the part that I still don't really understand. And I think that you need Sunil Gulati to better explain or someone inside U.S. soccer to really explain how the system is changing.
I think this is the most fascinating point. So when we look at U.S. soccer, men's soccer, we not only say the coach is flawed, but we don't have a system that can compete with the other systems. We either don't have a culture, we don't have a pipeline, all these things. And yet, with women's soccer, things are great. So how is it that the same people oversee a structure that get it totally right on the women's side to the point where we're either always number one or two in the world and just are an abject disaster? And I would say two things. One, it's just the quality of the players. Like, that's what it comes down to. And I know you'll say, well, the system can create better players. Can they? Can they really?
I wouldn't say that. The U.S. women were best in the world when there was no system.
Right. So we just have better women soccer players than anyone else in the world. And we just have
the rest
of the
world has worse women soccer
that's
players
the same
than the United
thing.
States.
That's the same thing. And we just have the 30th best men's soccer players as anywhere else in the world. And no matter how you tinker at the edges, you could get to one round further or a little bit better. But that's the situation. And the teams winning the World Cup aren't the teams. Yes, Iceland had a great run and Belgium maybe outperformed, but it's the teams.
Don't forget Greece.
Sure. They have a little bit of a burst that if the U.S. had won one more round against Ghana 8 years ago or whatever, however many years ago in South Africa against
Bruce
Belgium.
Arena got us to the quarterfinals, baby.
I know. So if we had one more win, maybe we'd say, this is a side point. My point is that it's just the players. It's exactly like the conversation around how do you create a great public school. You know, you have to have the students, the potential pupils who are ready to learn. You have to have the players who are good. And that's nothing that the people at the top can do, in my opinion.
Well, look, with the women, we were the first country to play women's soccer, to support it. That's a big advantage. In men's soccer, we didn't start playing it seriously for 30 years after
so
the sport was created.
We're thinking about this wrong.
Yeah.
We shouldn't make the U.S. team better. We need to figure out a way to make every other country worse.
Trump.
Yeah. But Trump, you're saying Trump should coach the U.S. men?
No, I'm saying somehow this is my opinion of what Trump's plan is. Make America great, .. comparatively.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when he did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
On Monday afternoon in New York City, Magnus Carlsen and Sergei Karjakin played the 12th and final scheduled match of the Chess World Championship. They played to a 45-minute draw. That leaves the championship tied at 6 points each, with the top-ranked Norwegian and the ninth-ranked Russian playing 10 draws and earning one win apiece. Carlsen and Karjakin will now play a series of championship-deciding tiebreaker games on Wednesday. We recorded the segment that follows before Monday's 12th game. Oliver Rader, who's been covering the championship for 538, joined us in our studio in New York to talk Carlsen and Karjakin and their battle for chess supremacy. Hey, Ollie.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing quite well. And, you know, nine ties is really what everyone in sports is looking for in terms of excitement. I've read kind of differing accounts of whether this has been a tense and thrilling championship match or a boring defensive one. How would you kind of describe it?
Yeah, I think the one big takeaway is that not all draws are created equal. So there have been some absolutely thrilling draws, especially games 3 and 4. They each took, I think, 6 and 7 hours, respectively, something like 75 to 90 moves, and they were real roller coasters. Carlsen was on the attack. He's the favorite. Everybody thought he would completely roll over Karjakin, and the match wouldn't take as long as it has, but Karjakin has basically been the Houdini of chess. He's been escaping from situations that even grandmasters in the tournament venue have thought were impossible. He's been constructing indestructible fortresses, and you know, frankly, it seems like he's lucky to be alive, but his defense has kept him in this match.
He's just like Putin.
he is, in fact, an avowed Putin supporter. He is from the Ukraine, but switched his chess allegiances to Russia, and even on his Instagram, he's sporting Putin t-shirts.
I think he would say he's not from the Ukraine, right? He'd say, I'm from Crimea.
That's
which,
right.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah. And so if he wasn't such a, I don't know how villainous he is personally, but certainly not aligning with what the magnanimous Magnus, the Norwegian heartthrob, or they want to make him into a heartthrob by pairing him next to Liv Tyler. I mean, he's not the pure villain. I think he'd have a lot of elements of the underdog, and not exactly out of nowhere, but he's not the second best player in the world, it would seem.
Yeah, that's right. So when they scheduled this tournament in New York, it's the first time it's been here since 1995 when it was on the 107th floor of the World Trade Center. The hope was that an American would be vying for the title for the first time since Bobby Fischer in 1972 when chess was really took over the U.S. It was a real fever in this country. And Fabiano Caruana is the top American player and the world number two rated player, grew up a little bit in Brooklyn. And the hope, I think, when they scheduled the tournament here was that we would have an American. But yeah, Karjakin, obviously I don't know him personally, but I've seen him every day in, you know, post-match press conferences, and seems like a sweet guy. You know, he's married, he's got a little kid, he's very, very soft-spoken, very thoughtful. And yeah, he certainly doesn't play the villain.
But it seems like the mainstream press, when something like a Chess World Championship takes place, wants to play up the geopolitical issues. There's a story on page one of the New York Times today that went way out of its way to talk about Putin and Norway and more flights over Norway by the Russians. It's almost as if, I don't know, we want to see Bobby Fischer against Boris Spassky in 1972 again because we love these sorts of political rivalries.
Yeah, I read that story this morning, Stefan, and it did a whole lot of work to sort of justify its headline.
The headline was a World Chess Championship, familiar overtones of East-West politics, Norway being the West and Russia being the East, although they touch.
Yeah, and I think, you know, by some measures, you know, Norway is the most democratic country in the world, and Russia is Russia. So, you know,
correction, they don't touch. Finland's between. But go ahead.
But, you know, I think covering these guys and thinking about chess basically for all of my working hours for the last 2 or 3 weeks, you know, I don't think that these guys are political. I think they're two guys who are really, really good at chess. And, you know, they're professional friends. They're like touring golf pros. That, you know, they go to tournaments together, and they're certainly rivals for these 2 weeks, but, you know, they seem to be on relatively friendly terms. So I think reading too many politics into the match is a bit of a mistake.
I mean, doesn't the geopolitical gloss happen because mainstream writers and, you know, I would put myself in this category too, just don't understand the game at the level that you would need to understand it to write about it as a sport or a mind sport even?
Right. And I think more so than just mainstream media and journalists, I don't even think a lot of the grandmasters at the match understand exactly what these two guys are doing. So grandmaster is a very, it's a very elite, you know, title. I think there's something like 12 or 1500 grandmasters in the world. But, you know, it's like the better you get at something, the more you realize how good people better than you are. So these are, you know, there's orders of magnitude within grandmasterdom. And even some of the commentators, I think, struggle to find the deeper meaning in some of these two players' moves. And it's, you know, been a very enjoyable struggle for me, but a struggle nonetheless to kind of bring, you know, a sense of drama and a sense of narrative to the games. And it's certainly there buried. But yeah, bringing that out, I think, has been a struggle for everyone covering the match.
It's classic Dumbledore and Grindelwald. I mean, even the grandmasters don't understand it. And by the way, the big tension, not just in this game, but in this interview, is do Norway and Russia touch? And in fact, they do touch, by the way. There's a little crossing. Sorry, Stefan, go ahead.
How much do the players themselves attempt to explain what has just transpired? I get the sense that this is not like a an NFL locker room where if you get the right guy, he's going to actually explain in some depth what he was thinking and what happened on a particular play. I'm not seeing a lot of that at this point. Will that happen later?
So, yeah, after every game, with the exception of one where Magnus angrily stormed out of the press conference, they do...
The one that he lost.
That's right.
Yeah, go figure.
That was, I think, game eight. So after every game, they'll do interviews and they'll go through the game together at a big desk in front of a press conference room, essentially. And they'll go through alternative moves and variations, but they do it so quickly and in such a coded grandmaster language that, speaking for myself, is very hard to follow. So they'll say, you know, what did you think on when you moved d4? Oh, I was thinking I was weak on the king side. Oh, but what about c4? What about the bishop? And they just rattle it off so quick. I mean, it's almost literally like another language. So they try to go through the game, but they're speaking at such a high level that it's difficult to make heads or tails of for a potzer like me.
So you got to look at their gameplay. So it's not how they explain it. It's you have to look at their gameplay and the computer can suggest other moves. And in general, we know what the results are going into this game, but in general, who has left, I guess, better opportunities on the table? Who's made the most of their opportunities?
Yeah, Carlsen has left edges on the table. I don't think anyone would argue with that. And you could also, I mean, you could flip the board around and say that Karjakin has found amazing defensive tactics and strategies. But I think I wrote a piece that went up yesterday at 5:38 that sort of plots computer calculated advantages throughout each of the 11 games that have taken place so far. And Karjakin's been fighting from behind, essentially. So he's gotten draws in 9 games, and he won a very unlikely win with black. So black moves second and has a theoretical disadvantage. And that's, yeah, I think he's been sort of fighting to keep his head above water in the match.
And the one game that Carlsen won, a long game, 6.5-hour game, and Karjakin surrendered. Why? Because he knew that he just saw it playing out and knew that he not only couldn't win, but he was going to lose eventually, or he just couldn't take it. Why did he surrender?
That's right. Yeah, I think that was game 10, and it got down to an end game where I believe Magnus Carlsen was up a pawn, and these guys are so good at calculating out and knowing what's going to happen, especially in the end game, and it was clear that that pawn would pose big problems for Karjakin, and he put himself out of his own
pawn,
misery.
What were the other pieces left?
I think it was 4 pawns to 3, if I'm remembering correctly.
And you know you can't win if you're 4 pawns.
I mean, to these guys, a pawn is the world. their world for a pawn. But it's interesting, you mentioned kind of the computer, and the computer is, it's software. It's computer engines, evaluation engines that give basically a number, and if that number is positive, the computer sees white as having an advantage. If it's negative, black. And this is sort of the lens through which, myself included, a lot of the spectators are viewing the match, because I can't, you know, I'm not good enough to look at this board and say, oh, I think black is slightly better here. So these engines are sort of the lens through which we're watching the match. It's very interesting.
But since Carlsen, or a great champion, can beat a computer, how much do we trust the computer to say that Carlsen's losing?
So Carlsen has absolutely no chance against a good computer.
Oh, really?
Computers, I could probably beat Magnus Carlsen with my iPhone. Computers have come so far since, what was it, 1996, the first Deep Blue Kasparov match. Computer engines make absolute mincemeat of top players.
Oh, wow.
So what is the experience like of watching the match then? You know, your analysis, as you just said, it's like, according to Stockfish, the engine, he was ahead here. And are you watching them on a screen and just looking for, like, maybe his brow is a little furrowed and I'm going to write about that in my dispatch? Like, how are you trying to take this all in as a reporter and an observer?
Yeah, I think it's worth a few words about what the venue is like. So it's being played in the South Street Seaport, which is basically the lower Manhattan on the East River. And it takes up a huge floor of one of the buildings down there. And most of the spectators are watching on flat screen TVs, basically. Some of them will pull out their phones to do analysis or laptops. Basically, the viewing experience at the venue is a lot like what you would get at home if you were sitting on your couch and paid the $15 to get the, you know, official app or whatever. You can see the actual players if you go into what is very reminiscent of like a reptile house in a zoo. You enter through dark curtains and it's very dimly lit, and you watch the players through very thick one-way glass, and you can see them, but they can't see you. So it's very, very odd. So I'll wander in there occasionally, but I think riveting is not the first word that comes to mind. I listen to the commentary. There's a grandmaster, Judit Polgar, one of the best female players of all time, who does commentary. She's very, very good and very, very insightful. And yeah, I've been kind of talking to people who aren't the players. So I'm talking to spectators. There's been a lot of kids at the venue who will, you know, sit cross-legged on the floor and play the grandmaster's games on their own board. So did a story talking to them. There's a very famous chess club in New York City called the Marshall Club, and I wandered over there one night and actually found Fabiano Caruana, who would have been the challenger, and he was there just playing speed chess just for fun. And so I chatted with him about what he thought of the match. So yeah, I've been kind of covering like the interest in the match rather than the players themselves. But I think once someone finally puts this thing away, I hope to sit down and kind of get their firsthand take on the match.
And let's also mention that in a sport, a mind sport, that is so given to draws, I would say that chess has tie-breaking scenarios so far superior to soccer, it's unbelievable. Can you tell me, so if this whole thing ends in a draw, tell me about the succession of different variations of chess that they go through.
Yeah, so this will be on Wednesday. And it used to be that if the match was tied at the end, the champion would have the right to sort of retain the title. And that's no longer the case. They'll actually break the tie. So they'll start off with four 25-minute aside games on Wednesday afternoon. So normal games, the full-length games, you'll get 100 minutes plus 50 minutes after 40 moves plus 15 minutes after 60 moves, so they can take 7 or 8 hours, but these will take about an hour maximum. So they'll do four of those. If those are still tied, they'll go down to 5 minutes aside, and they'll play two of those. Mm-hmm. And if those are still tied, eventually we'll get down to something called Armageddon, which, you know, I'm not supposed to root from the press box, but I very much hope we play Armageddon chess.
Yeah.
So how that works is the player with the white pieces will get 5 minutes, and the player with the black pieces will get only four. But the wrinkle is, if that game is drawn, black wins. Mm-hmm. So it's what's called time odds. So that,
do players ever just play Armageddon games for fun or in tournaments?
I'm not sure that there's Armageddon tournaments, but you can log on to most major chess websites and play Armageddon with anyone across the country, which, Stefan, we should absolutely do after this is over.
It's the high-low Omaha of chess. Now, I know chess people are brilliant, but why do they always have an even number of games? If they don't want it to end in a draw, I've just worked this out in my head, an odd number of games. It's like the Supreme Court.
No, it would just be like 6.5, 6.5 at 13 games.
Yeah, that's if you can draw an individual game, I guess the total doesn't matter that much.
Ollie, being part of the chess world as you are, but also part of my world, the Scrabble world, are there parallels in terms of how these subcultures see each other and see the potential for growth? Chess obviously has a much deeper base of participants and tournament play and cash prizes. But on some level, it's the same hoping for everyone to pay attention at some point. And that's what it feels like we had here, particularly with the chess organizers wanting an American to make the finals.
Yeah, I think I think there are parallels. I think, you know, Stefan, if you're at a chess tournament, everybody laments, you know, the prize money isn't nearly what it should be. The people watching at home aren't nearly what they should be. And the complaints at the chess tournament are exactly the same, right? But at this chess tournament, you've got, you know, an open vodka bar and you've got Russian oligarchs milling around. So it's sort of all relative. I think every mind sport kind of wants to be more mainstream. I think chess is in another galaxy than Scrabble. But there are non sort of economic parallels. The obsession is certainly present at both kinds of tournaments. Postmortems of games, sort of what would have been, you know, had I played this word here or had I moved this rook here, and sort of just obsessive analysis and kind of always wanting to master the game, be it a spectator or a competitor. I think the passion is the thing that is, you know, the biggest through line there.
Yeah, master the unmasterable. And also, I think the fact that at the very highest level, the players almost care less about winning and losing than they do about gaining a deeper understanding of the game.
Oliver Rader is covering the World Chess Championship for 538. You can read his coverage there. You can also follow him on Twitter. His handle is Ollie. He'll be tweeting about the final game on Monday, as well as the tiebreakers on Wednesday, hopefully an Armageddon game. Ollie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now it's time for After Balls, and there are a lot of great chess openings, defenses. I'm partial to the hippopotamus defense, the kangaroo defense, but mostly the hyper-accelerated pterodactyl.
You made that
That's
up.
Not I a real know. One.
That is a real one.
Oh, got to stick to your Ruiz Lopez, your Queen's Gambit accepted and declines. Your
Maybe
classics.
That's why Scrabble isn't as popular as
no
chess.
No good openings?
Great names for moves.
Well, they'd have to be the name of the word, and it's also random.
Be named after great players. It's not all just names.
The Ziziva opening.
Yeah.
Mike, what is your hyper-accelerated pterodactyl?
The SEC has 14 teams. Only four of them had winning records in conference. That's when one team goes 8-0, and a lot of the teams are middling. The only winning team in the SEC East was Florida, meaning Tennessee, a nationally ranked team, or at least it was until the rankings come out again, is 4-4, will not be competing in the championship game, will not be going to the Sugar Bowl as they had hoped, but did win a different championship. Their coach intoned before a game against in-state rival Vanderbilt, a game that Tennessee was expected to win. When Butch Jones said of his senior class, quote, "They've won the biggest championship. That's the championship of life." Twitter went nuts. It made mock-ups of the life championship ring with a lot of diamonds. It edited the Butch Jones, or rather the Tennessee Wikipedia page for its list of championships to include Championship of Life 2016. But then in a backlash, or a backlash to the backlash, there was the Tennessee denizens trying to point out that the senior class had gone through a lot, especially if you look at Butch Jones' actual words. Let me read them to you. The Rocky Top Insider said, this is the full championship of life quote from Butch Jones. "These individuals mean a lot to me personally." And you know that the personal is coming through when you talk about people. It's not just people, but individuals. "And they mean a lot to our football program. When we talk about winning championships, they're a champion. They've won the biggest championship, and that's the championship of life. And they're going to be college graduates. Some of them are already college graduates. What they've brought from a leadership standpoint, from a stability standpoint, from getting Tennessee football back." Again, they finished 4-4 in conference. "It used to be just win a game. Now it's not just winning the game," which is good since they lost half of them in conference. "It's how you win the game. And now it's what's next. That's everything that they've built over the course of time. I talked about being 14-3. This football program won't be 14-3 without our seniors. I'm indebted to them. Vol for life. I'll be a part of their life for many years to come. Well, that's nice. And then Tennessee went out and lost to Vanderbilt, meaning the Commodores made mock-ups on Twitter saying that they won the in-state championship of life.
Stefan, what is your hyper-accelerated pterodactyl?
Well, late in the third quarter of its loss to Ohio State on Saturday, Michigan was flagged for offside. Jim Harbaugh, however, apparently thought Ohio State jumped first. So, as we discussed earlier, the Michigan coach flung his play card in the air, spun around, and then spiked his headphones. The refs called unsportsmanlike conduct. Ohio State scored a couple of plays later. The flag was one more data point for Harbaugh's postgame complaints about the refs. More important, as sideline tantrums go, I don't think it really registers a mention among great tantrums, especially in the context of behavior at previous Michigan-Ohio State games, at least ones in which Ohio State was coached by Woody Hayes. Hayes was, of course, an Ohio State legend. He coached the team for 38 seasons, won 3 national championships. He was also known for his volatile Bobby Knight-like behavior with players, which regularly included punching, smacking, or hitting them, often on the helmet or pads. As one assistant on Hayes' staff told ESPN in 2013, he probably hurt himself more than anything. Two of Hayes' most memorable outbursts occurred during the annual Michigan game. In 1971, Ohio State, trailing 10-7 late in the game, was driving downfield when a pass was intercepted by Michigan defender Tom Darden. Here's another legend, Michigan radio man Bob Ufer, with the call.
The quarterback is Don Lampka. He has Wakefield out. He's back for a pass. He has plenty of time. He throws downfield, and it is caught. It's intercepted. It's intercepted by Darden. Darden intercepts it, his second interception of the afternoon, his fourth of the season, and Michigan takes over on the 32-yard line, and Woody Hayes is out on the field. Woody Hayes is out trying to intimidate the officials. Woody Hayes is out there right now, and I would rest assured that Ohio State will be penalized now because Woody Hayes felt that Tommy Darden interfered with his intended pass receiver. And Woody Hayes is right out there on that field, and he's being penalized 15 yards. Listen to the crowd as Woody Hayes is furious. He is screaming right up into the face of the umpire and the referee, and in a moment he's going to be kicked out of this ballgame.
All right, Hayes bumped at least one ref. He cursed, apparently, in the face of the others. Ufer, meanwhile, kept orating about Hayes here.
You might say that with all his wins and awards, and his Rose Bowl rings, it seems foolish, but Woody Hayes dwells in a unique jungle. The more you win as a great head coach, the more that's expected of you. Nobody escapes it. It's the elevator going up and down, Woody. It's been the same for all the great coaches, Yost, Chrysler, Darrell Royal, Vince Lombardi, and the final statement of that little oration by Ufer is that the magnified despair of defeat is the agony of success.
Wow.
Woody Hayes right now is suffering from the magnified despair of defeat, which is the agony you have to take when you're a successful coach.
Oh, the unique jungle.
Isn't that fantastic?
I love the unique jungle. How's that not a title of a way of a Hayes biography?
But what he wasn't doing there, Ufer, was describing what Hayes was actually doing at the time, which was destroying shit. He ripped up the sideline markers, threw a penalty flag into the crowd, then he grabbed the first down marker from the chain gang guy, ripped out one of the black and yellow inserts, and hurled the whole thing on the field. Then he walked 10 yards to the distance marker, ripped out the orange inserts from that, and the chain gang guy, like, engaged in a tug of war to not let Hayes take control of the equipment. All right, 6 years later, 1977, Michigan led 14-6, again late in the game, but an Ohio State receiver fumbled the catch inside the 10. Michigan recovered. ABC cut to a sideline camera showing Hayes cursing to himself. Then Hayes saw the camera, ran toward it, and appeared to kick the cameraman. The announcers were Keith Jackson and former Notre Dame coach Ara Parseghian. They didn't mention it until 4 plays later when they went to the replay.
Ohio State gets the ball at the 35. When Ohio State lost the ball a moment ago on the fumble, Woody Hayes, frustrated on an aggravating day, came plunging toward one of our cameras.
And I'm told that he took a swing at one of our cameramen down there.
Well, he's had a good year so far. So
Hayes, of course, would lose his shit for the final time a year later at the end of the Gator Bowl against Clemson. Clemson was winning by two, a couple minutes to go. Nose guard Charlie Bauman picked off a pass by Ohio State's quarterback Arch Schliester. He was tackled at the Buckeyes sideline, where Hayes grabbed him by the shoulder pads and punched him in the throat. Jackson and Parsegian were calling this game too, but apparently they didn't see the punch because they never mentioned it. And the one replay ABC showed obscured Hayes's punch. Woody Hayes was fired after that game. Josh, what's your hyper-accelerated pterodactyl?
I'm not sure if this has ever happened before. I guess we did have done coordinated afterballs before on purpose, but this can be like a sort of who wore it best us weekly thing. No, there's not that much overlap, actually.
Okay.
So one thing that we've learned during the Trump campaign is that coaches are assholes. Bobby Knight saying there's never been a more honest politician than Donald Trump. Mike Ditka saying, I think he has the fire in his belly to make America great again and probably do it the right way. That's a good one. Mm-hmm. Lou Holtz saying he stayed at Trump's hotel and that he does nothing but go first class in everything. Trump 2016. If he was still alive, though, Woody Hayes would definitely be supporting Donald Trump. Hayes, who won 205 games as the Ohio State football coach before getting fired for punching Clemson's Charlie Bauman on the sideline of the 1978 Gator Bowl, was a lifelong Republican, and his friend Richard Nixon gave the eulogy when Hayes died in 1987. In 1979, a few months after Hayes punched an opposing player in the throat, that being Charlie Bauman, Nixon sent him a letter that read, "Our mutual friend Cy Laughter sent me a Woody for Senator t-shirt. I think it is a good idea. Even better, I think, would be Woody for President. I am sure that our Russian friends," in quotes, "wouldn't dare try to push us around in the Persian Gulf, Africa, Latin America, or other places in the world if they thought you had your finger on the button." Why would Nixon say that? Well, in 1969, Hayes said that the hundreds of unarmed Vietnamese civilians who were slaughtered at the My Lai massacre deserved to die, adding, "And I wouldn't be so sure those women were innocent. The children are obviously innocent if they are less than five." In 1978, just a few months before he got fired, the BBC aired a 50-minute documentary on Hayes as part of a series on 13 American archetypes. Among the other people profiled were a private eye, a preacher, and First Lady Rosalynn Carter. Here is a clip from that documentary, which I found via Sports Illustrated's Andy Staples, who tweeted about it last week.
Woody Hayes sees himself as a commanding general. He even studies military history and uses it all the time to provide homilies and illustrations when training his players. He considers only total victory as an end to all this.
But they must have a winning instinct.
Oh, absolutely. Well, things say, I don't care if they win or not, we don't want them. Because we do want to win, because winning is the epitome of team effort. And we must keep that, and we must inculcate that into our football players.
Would you use the word indoctrinate?
Yes, I would very much. So many of our liberals are against that word, but I am not.
Classic liberals hating indoctrination. There is 7 minutes of this documentary on YouTube. It also includes a scene of Hayes yelling at one of his players for missing an assignment in practice before slapping him very hard across the ass. And the clip ends with this, which is going to make Stefan run through a goddamn brick wall.
Philanderer. That's a philanderer, a fellow who makes love triflingly. All right. In other words, he'd just about take on any gal that comes down the street.
The coach is genuinely concerned, as a teacher, about the lack of vocabulary in high school graduates. So all the freshmen volunteer, whether they like it or not, for his own Sunday morning classes on word power.
Spell it now.
A-P-A-T-H-E-T-I-C.
Oh, all right. That's a good word. All right. And it comes from another prefix.
It goes on like that for a while. Woody Hayes, word freak. Stefan's mouth is agape. He wanted to make America's vocabulary great again.
Yeah. Wow. Woody Hayes,
word freak. We'd love your feedback on what we talked about today. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. Also gather links to the stories we discussed at slate.com/hangup. Subscribe in iTunes. You can find us at itunes.com/slatepodcasts. Leave us a comment and a rating. Become a fan of Hang Up and Listen at facebook.com/hangupandlisten. Our intern is Shane Monahan. Our producer is Mickey Kapper. The executive producer of Slate's podcast is Steve Lichtai. And Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply. Hang Up and Listen is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Remember, Zelma Obeidy, and thanks for listening.